Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie and John here with another case. What's up, buddy?
Dude, how you doing, man?
Doing okay. I mean, you and I are kind of feel like we're passing a cold back and forth. So yeah. Neither of us really at 100%, but
I feel really good, but there's like, I don't know, just a constant crud that stays with me.
Constant, you know? Crud.
And his name is Jamie.
It's a good band name.
Oh, are we going to talk about the crime that was the UK football game where they beat up Florida so bad that they should probably be arrested?
I'm checked out on college football. So I, as a Kentucky fan, have moved on to basketball already. But
it's football season is pretty much over. Tennessee is out of the running for a playoff. So when I'm sad, I like to look at our Patreon and remind myself that there are at least a few people who are in my life that care about me.
Well, we got it. Thank them.
Yeah. Michael came in 2 days ago. So Michael, thank you so much. Also, Rebecca came in a little over a week ago. So Rebecca, Michael, thank you guys so much. We appreciate it. Michael, you will get an autograph in the mail pretty soon. So thank you.
Awesome. Really appreciate you guys. Also got a couple 5-star reviews that came in over on Apple Podcasts. I'd like to thank Kimmy429. Sounds a lot like the Jeremiah Johnson, loved it. The title, That's a Mad Trapper. That was one of our episodes a few years ago. This one's from Minko Bub, MinkoBub. Love how it's done. Good podcast. So
appreciate it.
Short, simple reviews. You don't have to be long-winded and eloquent. Also a great way to give us episode suggestions. So
when you hear the name Kimmy, what's the first thing you think of?
Gibbler.
Kimmy Gibbler from Full House.
Every time.
Sorry, Kimmy. I'm sure that's probably the first time you've ever heard that. I'm kidding. I bet you get it all the time, and I'm really sorry.
Sad day. That's okay. I bet she gets it. The Gibbs came around by the end.
All right, man. We've got a case. Why don't you get the ball rolling?
All right. This is going to start out on the morning of May 24th, 2004. Barbara Hanna got a strange call. It was from her brother's job. She was listed as his emergency contact, and he hadn't shown up for work for hours, which was very unlike him. He was normally early, if not on time. Unfortunately, Barbara lived in Virginia, and her brother lived and worked in Denver, Colorado. So a lot of times an emergency contact is somebody that can hop over and check on you. She can't really do that at this point. Now, her brother was 53-year-old Al Kite. When Al didn't answer her calls, Barbara called the Aurora Police Department to do a welfare check on her brother. Aurora Police went to Al's townhouse later that afternoon, and things didn't look out of the ordinary. It looked like nobody had been there, like he had just gone out to work and not come back. They knocked several times, but just to be sure, they went ahead and went into the house. Inside, everything looked normal too. They checked the upstairs bedroom and then made their way to the basement. All of a sudden, things were no longer normal. When they got to the basement, they found something that was completely horrific.
So let's back up just a little bit. Oakley Albert Kite Jr. was born on May 7th, 1951 in Nash County, North Carolina. He was born to Oakley Kite Sr. and Edith Davis Kite. They also, of course, had a sister, Barbara. Growing up, Al would go by Al in order to differentiate himself from his father. His father was a well-renowned dog trainer who co-founded a dog training company in North Carolina. Al's mom, Edith, died in January of 1970 when Al was only 18 years old. Al attended Weldon High School, where he met a friend named Gail Kay, and the two of them remained close even when Al went away to school. But Al didn't go too far. He went about an hour away to Atlantic Christian College, where he majored in business administration. In 1971, Al started working for a large engineering service company and would stay with his company for the next 30 years in roles that took him really all over the United States.
Right. And, you know, a lot of times if you have a close friend in high school and that's somebody you could romantically be interested in. That's what happens. And Al married his high school friend turned sweetheart, Gail Kay, in 1976. The two had had other relationships over the years. By the time they finally got together, Gail already had a child. She had a daughter named Julie. Al and his stepdaughter were incredibly close. Like we said before, Al's job took him from positions to Massachusetts and Texas, New York and Nevada, Wyoming to Tennessee, literally lived all over the country. And that really put a strain on his marriage and his relationship with his stepdaughter, Julie. So after 12 years of this, Gail and Al ended up getting divorced. In 1998, Al was offered an opportunity to move to Colorado for work. He immediately accepted because he loved doing all kinds of outdoor activities like golfing, camping, skiing, especially if you like stuff like hiking, like Denver, generally Colorado, the Rocky Mountains, everything you want to find is going to be there. Al bought a two-story townhouse with lots of room, which Al found funny since it was way more than a middle-aged man living by himself needed, especially since he was hardly ever there, but he had the means and got himself a home.
At work, Al was a comforting and helpful presence. He was reportedly always going above and beyond for his teammates, and he was just known to be a very warm and welcoming guy, always with a big smile on his face. Sometime in the early 2000s, Al renovated the basement of the townhome that he bought to be a standalone apartment, and he found a tenant that could help with the mortgage. In 2004, he started dating a woman named Linda Angelopoulos. They were dating casually, and they were both kind of in conversation of trying to make the relationship more serious. But then around the same time, the tenant that Al had been renting to for a couple of years said that he was going to be leaving in a few months. So this person moved out in May of 2004, so Al had to start looking for a new renter.
And that's tough. I've never been in a place where I've put out like an open call for a roommate. Have you done that?
No, I would. I don't think I would ever do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty common, though.
I would get four jobs to pay for it before I would live with a stranger.
Especially in bigger cities, a lot of people can't afford a place, so you're looking for a new roommate. I guess in college, I had a roommate that I didn't know when I got there.
Yeah, I was assigned one in a dorm, and then that didn't go well. So yeah. I ended up moving in with somebody I knew.
Right. And usually that's a well-monitored situation. It's not somebody coming into your house. So this is a tricky situation. On May 19th of 2004, there was a guy that responded to Al's listing for a roommate. This man called himself Robert, said he was hoping to move in as soon as possible. To secure his spot, Robert offered a security deposit and first month's rent right away. And I think one of the primary things you're looking for as a roommate is somebody who can pay the bill. So if this guy's got the means to pay up front, more than likely he's in a decent spot. Now, Al, when talking to Linda, told her about Robert, saying that he had just moved to Denver. He had been from the East Coast and was working for Wells Fargo. Linda said she never saw Robert. But there was one time she stopped by the townhouse to use the bathroom, and Robert quickly found a reason to leave. She said, he didn't want me to see him at all. I only saw him for just an instant. She didn't see his face, but she did see that Robert dressed very well in a nice pair of pants and a suit coat. So
that's like a description no one could ever give of either of us, you know?
Yes,
they were in hoodies and shorts, and it was really cold outside.
All the time. And it's just odd that he responded quickly to the ad, said he wanted to move in immediately, was very upfront with Al, but to avoid Linda like that is just very awkward and, to me, off-putting up front.
Well, it didn't really stop there. So one of Al's neighbors remembered seeing Robert leaving the home on May 19th, which is likely when he was leaving from this first meeting with Al. And over the next couple of days, two other of Al's neighbors had some strange run-ins with Robert. One neighbor tried to approach Robert and was completely ignored. Like, they said that he was looking straight through them, didn't even acknowledge their presence. Another neighbor said that she walked past him on a nearby walking trail, and again, he just seemed to stare right through her, didn't talk, didn't acknowledge her presence. I'm trying to think back if I've ever had encounters with anyone like that, and I have, and when I do, I'm just like, man, what's wrong with them? Like, Like, is it me? Is it them? Obviously, it's them. They're arrogant.
Because you're trying to be friendly, right? Like, yeah. I don't know. I assume hiking in Colorado is like hiking here. You say hi to people when you pass them on a trail. You at least give them a smile and a nod.
So Al didn't know about any of these things because, remember, he's talking to Al, right? But he agreed that Robert could move in as soon as he was able. And on May 22nd, Al drove Linda to the airport. She was going to be on a week-long trip. And when she got to her destination, she called Al. She said that she landed at around 3:30 p.m. and that Al was in a good mood. She said that he told her that he had been very productive that Saturday, that he'd been fixing a pipe in the basement and really just getting everything ready for Robert, who was going to be moving in soon. Dude, this would be the last time that anyone would have talked to Al.
Yeah, obviously, anytime somebody goes silent or you can't reach them, especially now, but even in 2004, I think by that point, most people had cell phones. Now, you're not tracking them on Find My Friends, but you can contact people most of the time.
That was the old school flip phone days for me.
It really was. And I mean, they were pretty reliable, pretty durable. So, and you would have to think, as successful as Al was professionally, that he had the means to have a phone, but they couldn't get a hold of him. Now, going back to that day on May 24th, when police arrived, they went into the house. Everything looked normal on the main floor and upstairs. But when they went down to the basement, they found Al lying face down in a pool of blood. Blood spatter was along the wall, all over the floor. It was obvious that something very violent had happened there. It's not like he fell and hit his head and just bled there. There was blood everywhere. Detective Sobieski of the Aurora Police Department said that the crime scene was the worst he had ever seen.
That's, you know, when you're a detective and you say that, that's so much different than like a rookie cop saying that, right? Like, yeah, you've seen some stuff to be able to be eligible to be a detective. So, and this, again, this is the Aurora Police Department. Now, I know that the massacre in the movie theater had not yet happened, and I'm sure that was probably one of the worst things detectives would end up seeing, but this is not like a small town. There would be right. some stuff happening in this town.
Right. Absolutely. So he had seen some stuff. He said this was the worst he had ever seen. The way he described the scene is that Al had essentially been hogtied and was nearly decapitated. The bottoms of his feet were up in the air and they were bruised. The coroner assessed the torture to his body and concluded that he had been tortured for hours. There was a wound on the back of Al's head showing that he had probably been hit from behind to start the attack, to be rendered helpless, probably while he was walking down the stairs. From there, the attacker tortured Al. He ended up stabbing him 22 times. Sobieski explained, some of the injuries were things I'd never seen before, like a knife into the area above the eye, into the ears, down through the shoulders. Just a crazy amount of torture and pain inflicted on Al. It appeared that Al had died just hours after his last conversation with Linda, which was, again, 2 days before he was found. His conversation was on May 22nd, and this was on May 24th. And everybody just assumed that he was late for work, but Al was nowhere to be found because he had been brutally tortured. Now, obviously, we're setting this up potentially to talk about Robert being involved, but when we get back from the break, we'll talk about where investigators started and what they ultimately found out.
Investigators dug in and they found quite a bit. They found out that Al and Robert had been talking about a recliner in the living room that Al wanted to move to the basement. So the working theory is that he and Robert were moving the chair down into the basement when Al was struck while offering help to someone. Evidence also showed that whoever attacked Al also ate food from Al's refrigerator, took a shower in his bathroom, took a nap or slept overnight in his bed, and then put on Al's clothing afterwards. Now, a neighbor indicated that whoever the killer was left the townhome early Sunday morning. So again, he received a call from Linda at 3:30. They think that soon after that call was when the attack happened. So the killer presumably spent the night in Al's bed, woke up, put on Al's clothes, and then left. This is just that, coupled with the brutality that you mentioned earlier, is one of the most insane things I've ever heard. So like the detective said, this is not stuff you see all the time. This is not like, you know, most, I would almost venture to guess that most murders are, they know each other, the suspect and the victim, right?
Right.
Now, authorities noticed that they had made sure to thoroughly clean the scene before they left. The place had been wiped down for any fingerprints. They had taken bleach and poured it down the drain, and including the shower drain. And then any items that they had touched were in a sink and were also filled with bleach. Now, the sink had several items, including a drinking glass, a pen, and Al's car keys.
Also had several knives in there, presumably some that were used during the attack. And yeah, I think this is so scary because, yes, the brutal murder, the torture, I feel like that happens often in the cases we cover. Maybe not the torture piece, but the brutality and the violence. But the cognitive presence to go and have a snack and take a nap after in his bed, I feel like that's a different kind of, I'll call it a different kind of crazy than we're used to, John. Authorities immediately tried to consider motive for killing Al. Who would do this? Who had a reason to kill Al? He had been tortured and tormented. This didn't seem like a robbery, like just a hit put out, anything like that. This seemed like somebody who was very passionate about hurting Al. But when they looked into his life, there wasn't anybody who seemed to have a reason to pick a fight with him. Then they considered that this could have been some type of robbery since there were some things missing, and maybe the scene was so violent just to throw them off the trail. They did take his car when they left, and they took his cell phone, which was, again, they could track it at the time, but it was a lot harder back then. Later that same day that they had discovered the body, investigators found his blue and gray GMC pickup truck parked a block and a half away from his townhouse. Police searched both the house and the car, hoping to find any bit of forensic evidence. They were able to find some trace amounts of DNA, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but this person was super careful with DNA, with fingerprints, with everything. They also found that rental application that Robert had sent in Al's trash can. It had the name Robert Cooper on it, along with an address, a social security number, and a phone number. The address supposedly belonged to Robert's sister, who he had temporarily been staying with before moving in with Al. It was actually a building on the University of Colorado's medical school campus. So this address was just something that he had plucked off the internet or out of a book or out of the phone book or something.
Or you think, was it something that was familiar to him and that's why he chose it?
Yeah, it could have been some kind of, it's hard to connect to a person like this. So I think speculating on that, like there could be a number of reasons that he would have picked that spot. The social security number belonged to an 80-year-old woman who lived in Indiana. So this could have been random numbers he put together. He could have stolen it somewhere. And the phone number was from a burner phone that they could not track. It was bought in March of 2004, but the owner waited 30 days to activate it just after the store had deleted its surveillance footage of who bought the phone. There was no way to see who had purchased this phone and no way to know who had activated it.
In 2019, there was a guy named Paul Holes. He hosted an episode of his show that was called The DNA of Murder with Paul Holes, and it was dedicated to Al's case. So in it, he says that the burner phone showed a level of pre-planning. Authorities learned that Robert used the phone to contact people who were renting properties. So this led them to believe that he was actually using this phone, calling those numbers, and hunt for victims. Holes believed that this person killed Al to get off on the homicide. It's like he's looking for a thrill. So he is torturing and killing people almost like a means of sexual gratification, like just really has to do it in order to go on. Investigators started asking neighbors what this man looked like, and he was described as a man in his 40s with dark, wavy hair, approximately 5'8" tall and weighed about 180 pounds. You're literally looking for just the world's most average man with wavy hair. Witnesses also said that he walked with a limp and used a cane. Now, that is significant because in your 40s, not many men are using canes to walk. Investigators also talked with other renters on Robert's phone record. At least three of them saw him in person, and each of them remembered a man with different characteristics. It was like he was putting on a different persona or personality and characteristics for each landlord that he rented from. One woman told authorities that when she met Robert, the hair on the back of her neck stood up. She just knew something was wrong with this guy. This particular woman actually taught Romanian at a local university and said that Robert had a slight Romanian accent. So, now, I mean, you wonder, like, is he putting on to get closer to her, or is he actually Romanian? And I think probably the former rather than the later.
I think that's accurate as well. I think he probably researched her and knew where she worked and just tried that to get an in with her. You mentioned that the limp was significant. Have you seen the movie The Usual Suspects? I feel like
it's been a long time. That's so, where they have the board behind the detective.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a big moment in there where maybe somebody was faking a limp to try to get away with something. So yes, significant if it's real. And I wonder if that was reported by every person that saw him. We don't know that for sure.
I almost doubt that. I think it was probably just a way to be remembered, and then police are going to be looking for somebody with a cane and a limp, and he's not using a cane or have a limp, you know?
When authorities did track Robert and Al's cell phones, because remember, he took Al's phone, it turned out that they were together, and they were moving through Denver. They found both phones abandoned in the Five Points area of Denver, where many homeless people often hung around. It was assumed that the killer knew these phones would be picked up, and he knew they would be used by homeless people, which would throw off the tracking of the phones. They probably wouldn't be able to name where they got them. They also checked Al's financial history and discovered that his credit cards had been used substantially in the days following his death. His ATM card was also used on the night of his murder, May 22nd, and the receipt for this withdrawal was found in the passenger seat of his truck. When they visited the nearby Wells Fargo, which is where Robert said that he worked, they were thrilled to learn that that ATM had a camera. So they believe that since the card was used there, they could see the person, finally see the face of presumably Robert. However, when they got the video, they saw the killer in Al's truck, but he was wearing a ski mask over his face when he approached the ATM. He also wore gloves, so there were no fingerprints in the truck. There were also none on the ATM. So even though they knew where he went, had a camera where he was going, he was prepared for all of this. So this person was very methodical and well thought out.
As investigators dug deeper, they found a lot of reasons to rule out robbery. For one, the killer only withdrew an even $1,000 from the bank account, even though there was much more in that account. So it does not seem like robbery is what he wanted. Also, nothing of great value seemed to be missing from Al's home. And after talking with friends and family, they learned Al was the kind of man who would have easily given up information like his PIN number if there was ever a robbery or an attack. His girlfriend Linda said if somebody would have said, "Give me all your money," he'd ask why, but he'd give it to you. This meant the torture was unnecessary, simply something the killer wanted to do rather than to get something from Al. Investigators started to think the killer planned out everything in advance and did it simply for the thrill of murdering someone. Al's sister Barbara said this about the killer, quote, "It's so hard to imagine why this was done. This guy was doing it for the thrill. He just wanted to find people to kill that he brought his own little torturing kit. He knew he had all the time in the world, end quote. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, he knew probably that Linda was going to be gone for a week, and he had all weekend to do whatever he wanted.
So the theory here is that Al was targeted because he lived alone, and they found him because he was looking for a roommate, and he didn't have a lot of friends and family in the area. He very much kept to himself, so there was nobody local that was going to be missing him. Also, Al was a very kind-natured guy, so he was probably easy to take advantage of. He was pretty desperate for a roommate. And because of the level of planning involved, police suspected this was not this person's first kill. Some even thought it may be the work of a potential serial killer. The police put together a list of characteristics of the profile of the person they suspected, and they released it. Now, this person could have been out from the East Coast. While he had lied about working at the Wells Fargo in Aurora, he could have been a banker from the East Coast, and he probably did like to dress up and look presentable, seemed like a professional individual on the surface. They may have had a female relative in the Denver area, and they may have tried to be a police officer at some point. As being out there, he obviously had to be staying somewhere before he allegedly was going to move in with Al. And for the police officer piece, that's because the behavior of using mind games to confuse police might have come from some kind of grudge against police themselves. So maybe he had failed a test to get in the academy. Maybe he had been denied a job as a police officer. But he obviously was out there looking to kill somebody, looking to be violent, and took joy in making the police chase their tail.
On Paul Hull's show, he consulted with a binding expert and an intelligence analyst to look at the ropes and the torture techniques that were used. And Al was tied up in a pretty particular way, so they theorized that the killer could have been a sailor, someone in the Coast Guard, something along those lines. And they also looked at the unusual way that he was hogtied. Most people, when they're bound up in crimes like this, they're usually bound by their ankles or their wrists, but Al was bound by his upper arms above the elbow and then twice around the knees or above the knees. So this is something that's different, you know, like this is, you just wonder if he's done this before and if this was something that, I don't know, it just breaks the norms of most crimes, right?
Or he hadn't done it before and this was his first time, which I would think the wrists and the ankles will be the obvious place. So I tend to believe that he had done this before and he knew it would work for what he wanted.
So you mentioned that he had bruises on his feet. So with the bottoms of his feet exposed, experts suspected that this was a form of foot beating called falaka. This is a practice that is common in Turkey, and it is allegedly a way to extract information or to beat someone into compliance. Now, his sister and others think that he would not have needed to be beaten to give up his PIN number. Was there another piece of information, or was this just some sick psychopath's, you know, this was his gratification of torture? So falaka is usually performed with a cane or a switch, and there was a honing rod that was in the house in the bleach-filled sink at Al's house. Also noted that he walked with the cane, so was that also used? The expert said that the honing rod would have been very comparable to the instruments that were used in Turkey when they were carrying out this practice of falaka. They also noted that the way Al was tied up was very specific to a group called the Turkish Hezbollah, and that the group was known for their torture tactics. However, the group disbanded in the early 2000s, but this was around the time that Al was killed, and so some speculate that he may have fled the region in order to avoid capture, but then when he got here, he missed his old way of life.
Right, and I just think about, obviously, I've never been tortured in this way or seen anybody tortured in this way, but I just know how painful it is if you get like a stone bruise on the bottom of your foot and everything is just so sensitive. I know where I grew up, a lot of people ran around with shoes without shoes all the time, but I never could. I think it's a very sensitive area. Those bones are very small and brittle. So I think it was something just for fun, because like you said, he likely would have given up everything before anything like this happened.
I don't think you'd have to torture me very long before I'd give you access to my bank account. There's not enough in there that's worth dying over. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
I can get more money. I can't get my life back.
We don't have an outline of the process of what happened here. We do think Al was hit in the back of the head. And then during the course of this torture, we don't know what they went after first. Was it the stabbing and cutting? Was it the feet? Was it any other thing? I'm sure there was mental torture there as well that we just don't know about. So we don't know the order, but I think when any of it started, I would have been offering up whatever information. And I think Al probably was as well. Obviously, his loved ones were struggling to deal with this loss. His remains were ultimately released to his loved ones, and he was flown back to be buried in his hometown of Halifax, North Carolina. His funeral took place on June 2nd, 2004, was attended by Linda, Barbara, his stepdaughter Julie, and many other family, friends, and relatives. The case, at this point, has gone pretty cold. Police were able to uncover a few fingerprints and a small amount of DNA, which, again, they collected this in 2004. You had to have a lot of DNA to do stuff. But now you need less in order to do some testing. In 2017, they used it to try to create a digital image of the killer. They found out that he was of Southeastern European descent, so who knows if that was very recent, and perhaps that Romanian accent was real, or if that was back upstream in his DNA profile. The DNA was also uploaded to the FBI's National Combined DNA Index System, and there, to this point, have been no matches on this DNA. The Aurora Police Department also submitted a droplet of blood for genealogical testing. Those results were given to the FBI, who are currently working on building a family tree in hopes of identifying the killer, like the man going by Robert Cooper. And again, this is something that was used to catch the Golden State Killer. It's cracked several other cases. It's really the newest weapon that police departments have, but it's very cumbersome and hard to track down. So they're trying to do the genealogical testing to find his family. Hopefully they can find a family member and track this Robert Cooper, who I'm sure is not his real name, down as well. If you know anybody who you believe could have done this, if you happen to live in that area and you saw something, if you were visiting the area and saw somebody hiking who matches one of these descriptions, please reach out to Detective Thomas Sobieski at the Aurora Police Department, calling 303-739-6710. That's 303-739-6710. John, I think this is a case that can absolutely be solved. We cover cases that are a lot older with a lot less information coming from it. I just hope it's as soon as possible. Obviously, he's got a sister, an ex-wife, a stepdaughter, an ex-girlfriend, and so many people are hurting. And of course, this could be somebody that's going to hurt somebody else. So by catching him now, you could save other people's lives.
Absolutely. I think this is a serial killer. I mean, I hate to speculate, but why would this be the very first crime someone has ever committed? And if it is, and I doubt it is, why would it be the last? So,
right.
You have to wonder, like, has there been more murders with similar MOs in the area? Is this guy traveling all over the country, maybe all over the world to do these things? Yeah, I really don't know. Also, like, his DNA says that he looked as if he was from Southeast Europe. Well, I mean, that does do, you know, they do kind of look Turkish. So,
yeah,
it is possible, I think, that he could be from Turkey. And if that's the case, does he have the means and resources to travel all over the world? Because it's hard enough to track down a serial killer when they're traveling within the United States, unless, you know, their DNA does pop up in CODIS. But what kind of system is in place to track down serial killers if they're traveling worldwide? And I would say there is not one, unless the FBI has some really high profile cases that they have information on.
Which I'm not confident that they do. I think this is a situation where I think you're right. I assume he has killed before and likely at least attempted to kill after it. Now, his DNA not being in Namus is concerning. It probably means he has not been caught since, or it would be in there, at least in America. He could be in prison in another country. But I also think if he had done this before, and I would not be surprised at all, that it was somewhere else in the country. I don't think this was something that he repeated locally. Seemed to be too good of a planner to do that. And it's just really rare to see somebody who is so capable of planning something out so thoroughly and yet so disturbed that they're able to do this kind of torture. It's a horrible scenario all around. And yeah, I think we need to solve it soon, because this person, if out there, is still capable of all this.
I hope that there's a way with AI and everything that we have nowadays that there could be, you know, an online database for FBI, or, you know, some kind of system where worldwide, if there's a cold case, they could put in, you know, even if you could just do a search like the stabbing in the ear. Like, that is so odd that if it has popped up a few times, you know, maybe those cases are connected. So
I think it's all up to international cooperation, which countries are friendly enough with us to do that and to share those resources, and which are not. Do we keep it local? Do we just look in Canada and Mexico? Obviously, Europe should be of concern here. So I think that's more too many international politics than I'm equipped to solve. But I do think that the genetic genealogy, because people all over the world do that, right? Like, people all over the world do submit their DNA. So I think that could be the ticket to solving this, no matter where he is.
Yeah. I mean, with Ancestry, even, it doesn't have to be him that submits his DNA. He's probably never going to do that, but he had to come from somewhere. So if his siblings, nieces, nephew, whatever, submit theirs, then it would link back to his.
Absolutely. Of all the cases we've covered recently that are unsolved, I'm just as confident about this one being solved as I've ever been. So I think this can be done. I think it will be solved. Obviously the sooner the better. Really hard to put a timeline on it, but if we find anything out, we will absolutely share that. So make sure that you continue to tune in to True Crime Cast as we give case updates, often on Patreon, a lot of times over on TikTok, which is where our primary following is. Would love to have you over there. If you have any case suggestions or ideas, please feel free to put those in a 5-star review, or you can contact us at truecrimecast@gmail.com.
Guys, we appreciate you as always, and until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.